This is Seismic Sessions, enabling the financial services industry, a podcast show dedicated to two things, revenue enablement and the financial services sector. Join us as we feature experts and leaders across the financial services industry who discuss innovative and impactful ways to sell, market and deliver memorable client experiences through enablement. Let's get this Seismic session started. Welcome to this Seismic session. Today we are here to discuss the evolution of product strategy in FS and the impact AI will have on it in the future. Joining me today, I have my co-host Rachel here. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Gemma. Lovely to be here again.
And we are also joined by Conrad Ford, Chief Product and Strategy Officer at Alica Bank. Hi, Conrad.
Hi, everyone. Nice to meet you.
And finally, but not leastly, we are also joined by Kerry Ryan, Senior Director of FS Product Marketing at Seismic. Hi, Kerry.
Hi, Gemma. Hi, Rachel. Hi, Conrad. Glad to be here.
Awesome. I think this is going to be a really good discussion with everybody that we have here today. So I can't wait to get this one started. What we do at the beginning of every podcast, as our regular listeners will know, is that we ask each of our guests what enabling financial services means to them. So Kerry, if we can go to you first, what does enabling financial services mean to you?
When I think about enablement in financial services, it's first and foremost really around the relationship with the client, right? Be it a financial advisor, be it a banker, an agent, institutional salesperson, really equipping that individual with all of the capabilities that they need to foster meaningful relationships, right? At the end of the day, while there is, you know, selling that goes on in financial services, it's built on a bedrock of a strong relationship and trust, right? So making sure that anyone who's really sitting in front of that client and having those relationships is equipped with all the tools that they need to support them in terms of sourcing content, sharing content, getting skilled and being really effective learners as well. And I think it's at its highest level and highest value. I think enablement plays a really powerful role of really stitching together organizations. Sales and marketing are suddenly on the same page, right? They're thinking about the same things together and really how they can best support that client, right? So certainly I think it's a force multiplier for the industry.
I love the idea of stitching the different departments together as well. I think that's beautiful. And Conrad, yourself, what do you see as enabling financial services?
Yeah, I mean, at a sort of profound level, financial services done well kind of happens in the background. You know, people don't buy a mortgage, they buy a home, and a mortgage is a necessary evil. So I think the really exciting opportunity we have ahead of us as a result of digital as an enabling technology in particular is that we can do that more effortlessly and more in the background and more intuitively as well. In other words, be the right solutions at the right time in a way that simply hasn't been possible before the emergence of digital. So for me, financial services done well is something that works effortlessly in the background and is there when you need it. And I think we're kind of moving to a new phase of financial services as a result.
Yeah, completely agree.
Excellent. I love that effortless kind of framing of that. That's very elegant. So just to give some structure to our conversation today, as our regular listeners know, in each of our podcasts, we split out our discussion using our seismic terminology. So we look first of all at the tremors, so where the movements started, as you've referred to the shift that's taking place, Conrad. I'm sure that will come through in our further conversation. The epicenter, in terms of where we are now. And then we make our predictions for the future. So what will be the aftershocks? So for our discussion today, if we start with the tremors, and if we look back at how product strategy has evolved over the years, and what have been the main innovations and disruptions in this space to get it where it is today. So it's a question for both you folks, Kerry and Conrad, and I'll start with you, Conrad. I'm curious to hear, how did the world of product look when you began your career as opposed to how it looks now?
Well, interestingly, in a lot of the incumbents, it hasn't changed much at all. So, you know, if you have products in your title, let's say in a big bank, then more likely than not, your primary responsibility is to move stuff like the interest rates, the pricing, the term of financial services products. Now, to be clear, that's a very big job because a balance sheet of a large financial institution is tens of billions, and in some cases, hundreds of billions or trillions. So, you know, moving a few basis points on the interest rate is extremely consequential. And the people doing that, you know, if they get it wrong, well, as we've seen in America recently, it can go very wrong indeed. But it's a fundamentally different concept of products as it would be, or products as a specialism, as it would be understood in, you know, a modern technology firm, you know, the kind of Spotify type model, sort of cross-functional teams focused on an outcome with an end-to-end responsibility. Mm-hmm. So I think the financial services world is actually, it's in the start of a transition. And actually, I spend quite a lot of time with, you know, talking to people in the incumbents, and very often they're beginning to adopt the sort of terminology of how someone at Spotify would think about products as a discipline. But it doesn't necessarily come through that they're really doing it. They're kind of like they're saying, you're no longer a project manager or product manager. So I think in financial services, certainly in the incumbent industry, which, let's be clear, remain utterly dominant despite the impact of fintech, I think we're actually at the start of a transition to a different world. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, you've had the emergence of lots of fintech companies around the world. London, where I am, has been kind of at the forefront of that alongside Silicon Valley, but it's a global phenomenon. And you tend to find that the product as this one is, it much looks and feels a lot more as it is like you expect to find it in a technology company. And actually, when you get to the raw bones of it, the art of fintech is balancing the fin and the tech. As we saw when the interest rate environment changed very rapidly, the fastest interest rate rise in decades, it turned out that quite a few of the fintechs didn't understand enough about the fin. So it's a balance for you, to be clear, right? It's not as if, you know, modern fintech companies great, incumbents bad. The reality is the art of fintech is balancing the fin and tech. And, you know, one of the things I spend a lot of time thinking about, and I'm sure we'll get into this, is kind of how you fit modern product thinking to a traditional sector, and indeed the largest and one of the most, longest term sectors in the world. That's kind of the epicenter of how we move this.
That's really interesting. And that's that old adage, really, isn't it? That eventually all banks will become software organizations. But to your point, at the end of the day, they're still in financial services, ultimately. So I'd be interested, Kerry, does that reflect your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Conrad said it so well with that balance of fintech being a balance of fin and technology. So I think certainly we're ushering in a really exciting era when we start thinking about products and services that financial institutions are delivering to their customers, right? I think technology is going to play such a fascinating role. Clients are looking for more personalization in everything that they're having from the experiences that they're having with whatever institution they're working with, right? Like to Conrad's point, they're not buying a mortgage or a car loan. They're actually buying an experience, right? They're buying that new home. They're buying the new car, right? So the firms that are thinking intentionally on like that, striking that right balance of the financial services side and the technology side, I think that we're ushering into a really exciting opportunity with personalization really at the core. Because certainly it's been something that's been discussed for a long time, personalization, right? But it's easier said than done. So I think that's kind of like one facet of, you know, certainly what I'm seeing. And when I think about pure technology product, right, you think over the last like 25, 30 years, you know, with technology being brought to the market, both from a business and a consumer perspective, is a lot of times it was, oh, let's just introduce a new piece of technology. We're not exactly sure like how it's going to be used. We have a hypothesis that it could help with something. And I think what we're finding now is that we're getting a lot more mature, you know, between, you know, businesses working with technology firms, right? Understanding, okay, these are the outcomes I'm looking to drive. These are the business problems I'm looking to solve. Here are the pain points. And that's playing, I think, a greater role in terms of new product that's being introduced into the marketplace, right? I mean, we're seeing it a lot with AI, right? Like this big meaty term. But for AI to be really successful, you have to tie to a specific set of use cases. So I think that on the technology side of product is where it's all headed.
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting sector to look at of how that's going to go forward. I was going to ask actually, Conrad, if we look back, we can't really look back with Alica Bank only having got its banking license in September 2019 without looking pre-Alica Bank, if you like. And something I'm interested in here is what was missing from the industry that Alica Bank filled in terms of your offerings?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's notable about Alica Bank is focus. So we are extremely focused on what we consider to be an underserved and unfortunately large financial services opportunity. So what is that opportunity? Our customers are what we internally call established SMEs, or if you're in America, established SMBs. So they're not the millions of micro businesses. They're not the large corporates. They're the bit in the middle. So in the UK, there's about 500,000 of them. So if you want to think, who are those businesses? You know, when you go to a town you've never been to before and you have to do a U-turn in industrial estate, you've taken a wrong turn. And it's the little factories, warehouses, it's family-run hotels. So these businesses, in the UK, they represent about a third of the economy. But the big banks really struggle with them, okay? Now, the reason the big banks struggle is because they've got two major revenue centers. They've got consumer, us ordinary people. We're high volume, homogenous, simple to serve. And you've got corporates, the very large companies, the Vodafones or the American equivalents, which are extremely complex, but very valuable. And the big banks will throw lots of high quality people at them. So micro businesses, really small businesses, they're very much like consumers. And indeed, so one example is the most popular form of financing for a micro business is a personal credit card. So they act like consumers in all but name. Our customers are really awkward for big banks. They're too low value for corporate banking and they're too complex for consumer banking. So they kind of get structurally underserved. So we pursued, well, I'm a great fan of the book, Blue Ocean Strategy. So if you're into strategy, I'm a great believer in it. This is, for me, the consummate Blue Ocean Strategy, because for those that don't know, a red ocean, and most markets are red oceans, is a feeding frenzy, okay? You've got lots of competitors with similar propositions going after the same customers. And in the end, you've got two levers. You can either price down or reduce your service, and your margins will be hit accordingly. Occasionally, you find a blue ocean. And when you find a blue ocean, you can guess the rest. You go and grow. And we have found the blue ocean. And for those that don't know, we are the fastest growing fintech in history in the UK.
Wow.
That's official, by the way. It's a Deloitte number. So the UK has, of course, produced some stellar fintechs, the likes of Revolut, Wise. But we have actually outperformed them all with the highest revenue growth in history. And at the heart of that, I think, is that strategy point. In other words, product only gets you so far. But in the end, if the strategy is not right in the first place, and I think the alignment of products and strategy is an understated topic. So we've stayed laser focused on that segment. So what's important to that segment is it's that focus that allows us to serve those customers much better. So we can both be profitable as well as actually getting the economics right. And going around to foundational points around product, that left us one single problem we had to be brilliant at solving. And that problem is, if the big banks find those customers too complex for consumer banking and too low value for corporate banking, we're going to need an entirely new operating model and infrastructure that allows us to cost effectively deal with that complexity. Okay. So in other words, we had to learn to love complexity and make it our problem, not our customers. So we kind of went down to a really foundational level. We're going to have to build our infrastructure and operating model from the scratch, focus on that segment. And that's allowed us not just to be very high growth, but also profitable from a very early stage as well. So yeah, for me, it's focus is our special power. And making sort of a macro comment about financial services, I'm going to make a prediction. The thing that's going to kill the big banks, or at least bring them to their needs, is not fintech challenges. It's their own branches. Now, why do I think that? Because we have what's the sort of dominant form of banking in my lifetime, anywhere in the West, by the way, anywhere in the West, been universal banks. A universal bank that serves every type of customer, from the poorest student to the largest corporate. And they do every stage of the value chain. They do the manufacturing, the raw materials, which for a bank is cash, the manufacturing, creating products, and the distribution. Now, the reason they're universal banks, because obviously the downside of being a universal bank is you can't be great at everything. You're jack of all trades, as we say in the UK, and master of none. But the reason you're a universal bank is because branches are extremely expensive. So you put as much of the value chain through and as much of the types of customers over that huge overhead. Okay. Now, the problem they now have is people stopped going to branches, and it's a very acute thing in the UK, less than the US, by the way. But the number of people regularly going to branches is very, very small in the UK now. Then suddenly the entire rationale of being a universal bank kind of goes away. And it's kind of exposed the fact that they now have a very high cost thing. But what they don't have is the ability to be focused and really be brilliant at serving a particular segment. So that's what's different between us and the incumbents. We're very, very focused.
I love what you said there, where you say you make your customer's problem your problem. And I think that's how you create great product and strategy, is to give them exactly what they need to fill their problem or to solve their problem, rather than trying to give them a square peg for a round hole and hope that it fits somehow. Really like that point that you made there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess just just kind of building on, I mean, there were so many things that you covered off there. It's sort of unpacking it a little bit. When you talk about your superpower being focus, as we're entering this, or we are already in this world of AI, which is promising to disrupt things beyond recognition in some ways. So we've got a backdrop of continuous change, I guess, and rapid change at that. What lessons have you taken from the past in terms of staying innovative and ahead of the curve with regard to the product? And how do you see that panning out, I guess, as we kind of enter this golden age of AI?
Yeah, I think it was Bill Gates who said a comment along the lines of people overestimate how much they change they'll be 1 year and underestimate how much they'll be in 10 years. Mm. And I think AI is very much in that category. So, you know, when I venture onto LinkedIn, I'm bombarded with people telling me if I don't respond to AI tomorrow, I'm going to be out of business by Wednesday. And clearly that's not the case, as be blunt. But at the same time, I am reading a book right now called The Coming Wave, which is by one of the founders of DeepMind. Wow. I mean, God.
Yes.
I'm only halfway through it, but yeah. TLDR, we're all going to die. And it's happening extremely fast, right? You know, when you hear it from a practitioner of how quickly that the capabilities of AI are developing, it's quite extraordinary. And by the way, very credible. There's no hubris in there. It's fact, fact, fact. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of 1 year and 10 year thing is going to play out. So, you know, I don't have to drop everything and respond to this. But at the same time, if we don't start carving out time and resources to think about this stuff and begin to experiment, and we probably will be in trouble. So how has that panned out for us? So a lot of the activities that we do is quite offline, not because we're not digitally capable, because the market we operate in is not very digitally capable. So a real example there is we fund a lot of premises for businesses, so factories, shops, warehouses, and the market of how you do that, you know, the solicitors involved, the lawyers involved, except the agents, are very, very paper-based. So, you know, we would love everything to be APIs, but we can't make the world what it's not. So we are beginning to experiment internally. For example, you know, PDFs are very common in our world. So the world has moved from, you know, sending people post to PDFs. So there has been some modernization. So we are beginning to experiment with how we can actually automate in that, and actually, you know, with some successful experiments as well. So at the moment, it's kind of like, how can we use this technology to kind of marginally begin to drive down our cost to serve and quicken and improve our service to customers. But I'd say at the moment, we're kind of in pilot phase and the bubble that's running in parallel. So we certainly haven't got to the point of saying, well, you know, let's let the robots take over. So that's how we're approaching this. We're being measured. We're lucky enough, we happen to be on the Microsoft stack, Azure stack, which means that I think we can have a lot more confidence when we're told by our provider, you know, data that you put in this, you know, this variant is going to stay in a walled garden. We can be confident about that, which is great. Because it's a super important point to make, right? In financial services, we need to be extremely careful with the data we hold.
Yeah. Yes.
And actually here in Europe, the data protection laws are extremely severe.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, people don't like banks sharing their information anyway. So you have to be very cautious, and particularly so in financial services, I think it's a state of play. So we're beginning to experiment, but at the moment we're not letting off the leash.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's the currency of trust, I think, that Kerry referred to a little bit earlier on. It's so critical. I'd be really interested to get your thoughts on this, Kerry, because I know it's something that you've been assessing quite a lot in terms of AI and how to stay innovative against the backdrop of this change that we're all experiencing.
I mean, I think from my perspective, you know, obviously, I think all the smart institutions are really thinking intentionally and setting up, you know, kind of centers where within their organizations, depending on their size, to really look at AI intentionally, right? And I think about like JP Morgan in their last earnings talking about they've identified 400 use cases of AI across the bank, right? So I think having leaders who are thinking intentionally around like, let's go underneath the hood and really understand like the practical use cases, really speaking kind of what I was talking about earlier, not just thinking about AI for AI's sake, but saying, okay, let's look at all of the business processes, front, middle, and back office, and really think intentionally, like, what is the role of AI playing, you know, because it is a wide universe, right? And I think it tends to get thought of as like this monolith. And then when you kind of get underneath the covers of AI, it's, you know, there's just such an amazing opportunity to really think about, you know, is it using it for fraud detection? Is it using for risk management? Is it using to support customer service and sales, right? And really thinking intentionally, how do you have a team looking at AI, but looking at it specific to the use cases that are near and dear to their business units? I think that's where you're going to get like real success in driving value out of this incredible capability and really kind of riding the wave of where it's headed. Because I do think as the kind of the crank of AI continues to turn, it's going to be less of like, in the past, it was kind of like, okay, this is like centralized AI kind of think tank in these organizations. I think what you're going to start seeing is that's going to be like AI for everyone, and everyone's going to have to get really sharp on the utility of AI specific to what they're doing day in and day out.
Yeah, completely agree. And that brings us really nicely into the epicenter part of our podcast of where we are now. And I think at this stage, not only will we discuss that innovation that AI is bringing, but also we can't ignore the fact that we're all living in a very different world post-pandemic and how we can fit that into our hybrid way of working nowadays. So with all of the epicenter in mind, Conrad, I'd like to turn to you and ask you about personalizing customer experience. I know that you've already spoken a little bit about it so far, but I'd really like to understand how you're harnessing technology to deliver superior customer experiences in this hybrid world that we live. And in particular, when you say, you know, the branches are disappearing, how do we replace that in-branch experience online?
Yeah, I mean, so a starting point, for those that don't know, Alica is unashamedly, we believe that human beings are an important part of a banking relationship. So we haven't tried to be entirely digital. So we don't say there's an app and that's it. Our customers have complex needs, and indeed they very often want to speak to a human being. Mm-hmm. So the challenge that we have to manage, and in the end, it's as much a cost challenge as it is a service challenge. It's how can we give the human relationship aspect, make it work for us as much as it works for the customer. And to be clear, one of the reasons the incumbent banks have rolled back from the segment is so they couldn't make that work. You know, if you want to sort of picture what's the high level vision of Alica from day one, it's that, you know, what about if you want to go and speak to your bank relationship manager about whether you should buy your premises, for example, you don't have to put on that ill-fitting suit that you only wear to weddings and go and see the bank manager in a branch. Why can't they come to you and talk through your cash flow on an iPad? So the vision was effectively, I think it's fashionably called high tech, high touch. So unashamedly, human beings plus technology and using technology to enable that human relationship. So what does that mean in practice? It means that you very quickly get to the questions about omnichannel. And actually, so I was listening to a podcast the other day and somebody said they prefer the term opti-channel. And I like that. I'm going to take the opti-channel. So it's omnichannel is a bit weird. Opti-channel, what's the channel that's best for the customer and best for you? So how do we think about this? How do we make it work for the customer as well as work for us? Well, we believe, and I think we're seeing this now in our customer data as well, so it's very high conviction now. If you build effortless digital services, then the day-to-day banking and financial service activity, customers would generally choose to self-serve. So, you know, why would you pick up the phone to make a payment when you can go and do it digitally on your phone or the desktop? So customers will choose to self-serve on the day-to-day stuff as long as you actually get the technology right. But there are certain moments of truth when they want to be able to speak to somebody. And I say those two moments of truth are at polar opposites. One is a really exciting and positive one. So for example, they've got a really consequential decision. Should I buy my premises? I've now got an opportunity to buy my premises, but it's a really consequential thing. It's a life or death decision for a business. It could work out very well. It could work out really badly. I want to speak to somebody who actually knows what they're talking about. Yeah. The other extreme is when we drop the ball. You know, we're not perfect any more than the incumbents are. When your bank has dropped the ball, you want to be able to speak to somebody and that person to own the problem from start to finish. And what they currently get, by the way, is being bounced around a call center explaining the problem five times over. So it's not with us, by the way. We've been coming. So yeah, so those moments of truth, we want to be really open to the customer. And we try, you know, I'm also responsible for marketing, and we try and sort of really drive it through in terms of how we show ourselves to the customer. And I want to tell a little story, actually. So when I started hiring up our team of relationship managers, so this is the people that face off to our small business customers, they got really excited because we started building a profile page for each of them on our website. And I thought, my God, these people are really egotistical, right? The idea was you have a picture of them and they talk about their dog and they like to play golf at the weekend. In other words, just bring our relationship managers to life. But actually it turned out it wasn't egotistical. they found it revolutionary that we were putting their contact details on our website, because what they've been used to in the traditional banks where they come from was basically the customer was forced through the chatbot pretending to be a human being, and then a call center, and then only if you'd gone through 10 different levels, you know, like some computer game, did you actually get to speak to your relationship manager. Whereas our relationship managers, your email is right there on the website. So we want to send a really clear message. If you want to talk to your relationship manager, they're right there for you. So that's our kind of model. And we have to get the digital right and the channel strategy right to make that work for us. Because, you know, if our customers chose to speak to their relationship managers every day about every transaction they do, it's not going to work. So that's how we think about it. I'd add one more thing, by the way. You know, when Alica was envisioned, it was before COVID. We always assumed that face-to-face was super important to our customers. And it turns out to be quite important, but COVID has definitely made a difference. So we're finding a lot of our customers are very happy to do a video call. And indeed, some of them seem to prefer it. And by the way, I can get the preferred bit, by the way, because I used to be a startup founder. I founded and scaled a startup before my current role. I've been an owner manager of a business. And guess what? I didn't like to have face-to-face meetings, because if it turned out the meeting was going nowhere in 10 minutes, you've kind of got awkward 10 minutes of getting a coffee together at the start. You've got awkward 20 minutes of listening to them anyway and shepherding them out of the room. Us British are very terrible at that kind of stuff. So half an hour to get somebody out of the room because you're too polite. Whereas a Teams call, if it's not going anywhere, you can shut it off pretty quickly because they haven't traveled halfway across the country to see you. So yeah, so we do actually find that customers are much more engaging with video conferencing than we'd imagined, which of course potentially gives us a real, you know, a real weapon in our armory to drive forward that kind of a model that works for us.
That's fabulous. I think that's so true. And I wanted to kind of go back to, you started to talk about COVID and the impact that it had. And I want to lift the lid a little bit on what happens behind the scenes to make these strategies a reality. So I'm going to come to you, Kerry, with this one, just to understand a little bit about what impact hybrid working's had on your role. And I guess not just in terms of how you manage teams, but also how you strategize product marketing.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think all of us have gone through just a huge change over the last few years, right? And really trying to be intentional around what's that hybrid working model look like, you know, certainly. And in some cases, a fully distributed work model. I mean, I certainly work as part of a team and we're located really across the United States and in pockets of countries outside the U.S. So we are, you know, we get very intentional around how do we think about time we need to spend together on our virtual calls. We also, you know, we use a lot of collaboration software like Slack to really make sure that we're staying in touch with each other kind of in real time to surface up, you know, conversations. I think, look, it takes a lot of focus to think intentionally around how you make the model work, right? What meeting cadences make sense? How do people like to get communicated with, just in terms of, because it can easily get into a lot of meetings. It can get easily into too many meetings with too many people in it, which I think in some cases can hinder progress, right? So I think finding opportunities to really meet people. I think, you know, taking a page of what you were saying earlier, Conrad, that concept of opti-channel, right? Like knowing that, like when I'm working with Gemma or Rachel, knowing like how they want to interact with me, right? Is it us just getting and having a quick phone call, or is it us scheduling like a Zoom or a Teams chat where we're kind of seeing each other, quote unquote, face to face? And I think the smart firms are also finding, you know, pockets of opportunity where they can bring people together, you know, in person, you know, even if it's just once a year, because there's nothing like that human connection to really, I think, anchor the relationships that everyone has virtually. So I think it's all about being highly customized and intentional around how people like to work.
Yeah, and I think intentional is a big part of that as well. I think the next part that we need to move on to, because we can't look at where we are now without mentioning the FCA and Consumer Duty, which is changing the way that most financial institutions in the UK are serving their clients. Sorry to leave you out slightly on this one, Kerry, but I know you do have views on it as well from a global stance. But Conrad, I'd really like to understand, what's Alica's strategy on complying with Consumer Duty?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, if you take the letter of Consumer Duty, it doesn't actually apply to much of our revenues, because I've talked about before, we're kind of focused on established SMEs or SMBs, and they are incorporated businesses. But we chose from the start that we would act as if consumer duty applied to all of our customers. Now, I don't want to pretend that's, you know, taking some big moral ground, high ground that nobody else would do. I think most banks, I don't know for sure, but I think most banks in the UK took that decision. Could we really turn around to our regulators and say, well, you know, you don't get to touch that bit of our customer base? I don't think that's how things work. So we've chosen to apply consumer duty, and certainly in terms of the principles. Obviously, you can't take every single letter and apply it to a different segment. So we've chosen to apply it. Honestly, our view, I will get on my moral high horse. Honestly, my view is that if you're customer focused as an organization, it really shouldn't lead to that much change. And you can actually, you know, if you want to be polemical, you can actually go further. If you're a customer obsessed like Amazon, right? You know, there is, I actually looked into this at one point, right? There is no correlation, as far as I can tell, between being regulated and customer outcomes, when you look across sectors, by the way. So, you know, a customer obsessed business can emerge from anywhere. I think what it's actually exposed, bluntly, is that some areas of the incumbents have basically been taking advantage of customers, or customer behaviors is probably a better way of putting it. So, for example, customer apathy. So, you know, one of the kind of challenges that comes from consumer duty, and I don't claim to have an authoritative answer on this, by the way, but a challenge is, why is it that a new customer gets better pricing than an existing customer? Yeah, I don't know how, I'm not a regulatory lawyer, but that is a question I've heard asked a lot. Yeah. Or, for example, we've had a rapid rise in interest rates, and somehow the incumbents are extremely good at passing that on to their lending customers, but somehow they operationally find it very difficult to pass it on to their savings customers. Hence, we get a huge increase in profits amongst the banks. So I think if you're customer obsessed, or have, you know, sort of built with a sort of customer focused mindset, it shouldn't lead to that much change, because in the end, you're trying to build a sustainable business through customers wanting to stay with you and choosing to do business with you and share more of the financial life with you. And at the moment, we are in that kind of transition from being a product, you know, a business where customers have a product, to a business where customers bank with us, which is a much more, you know, deeper relationship. So I personally think that it's kind of exposing some difficult questions for some of the incumbents, particularly around how they treat existing customers. You know, we've been lobbying quite hard on this, by the way. So one stat is that SMEs in the UK are losing out on about £7.5 billion a year of interest. And that's money that's sitting in current accounts where the banks have chosen not to tell the customer they might be able to get some interest. Or also the fact that there's a bit of a penalty because they pay more interest to larger corporates than they do to SMEs. So we've been lobbying quite hard on this, but that kind of stuff shouldn't happen in a world where you're kind of focused on customer outcomes. But it's a huge impact to the industry. And I've sat on some senior management roundtables in the industry, and I have to say I've heard some examples that they're concerned about that kind of feel like it might actually have some unexpected consequences. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, customers that are at the margin in terms of affordability, customers that are historically underserved may actually get more underserved. I hope the regulator is very eagle-eyed for any adverse consequences that it didn't, or unintended consequences. But it's a big, big deal, I tell you that. If it comes into your market, be warned.
I, you know, you raised some really good points there. I think the FCA are acutely aware of the need for the customer obsession piece. I mean, they talk quite a lot about the fact that it's not one and done, and that it will require cultural change. So I think, to your point, we are going to see some quite wide-ranging shifts within financial services over the next year or so as this comes to, you know, comes in. Well, it's already into being, but I think the response and the consequences of it are felt more keenly.
Yeah, Kerry, I'd love to come to you at this point and just ask you, how have you seen the banking industry leverage tech to navigate around consumer duty?
Yeah, I think, look, when I think about consumer duty and I think of similar regulations that are happening around the globe, really all centered around the best interests of the client, right? Like, how are these institutions really thinking intentionally, right? Because financial products are so important and so vital, right? And inclusion of those options across different wealth bands is so vital and important. So I think, you know, certainly is the role of technology. I think what we're seeing a lot more is the need for leadership to really have a greater amount of oversight on in front of, you know, the bankers or the advisors who work as part of a bank structure. We're seeing a lot more focus on really having a better understanding of what's happening with those relationships. And certainly you saw a couple months ago, the new head of Citi Global Wealth, really, you know, an organization that has a great footprint around the world, coming in and saying, you know, they want to have more call reports coming out of with the private bankers, right? They really want to get underneath the hood to understand like what's happening with those relationships and really having kind of the traceability to understand at a leadership and a managerial level, like how are these relationships being supported? What kind of conversations are being had? What products and services are being kind of offered to make sure that, you know, those specific set of needs are being met? You know, and then certainly that's on the high end of the wealth spectrum, but certainly a lot of customers are coming to us at Seismic and saying, like, we want to apply that kind of philosophy really across our customer base because we want to make sure that we're really acting in good faith for our client base, regardless of, like, if they're a business customer, they're an individual of a variety of different kind of wealth tiers, if you will. So I think that's going to be vitally important. I think the role of technology, and I think certainly we're thinking a lot here at Seismic of like, how do we make that process just simple and easy, knowing that that can introduce a lot of complexity into the walls of a financial services institution, right? How do we think about, you know, not only like checking a box in terms of satisfying a regulatory requirement, but how can we think about technology that checks the box on that, but also is giving a great experience for the banker and for the client, right? In terms of those conversations that are happening regularly.
Yeah. And this takes us quite neatly, actually, to the aftershocks section of our conversation. So if we look forward and we talk about where we see the future of product strategy in financial services, and think a little bit about how we can improve the current status, but also how AI, I guess, in particular, will impact on this. If I start with you, Kerry, we've already talked a little bit about how AI is revolutionizing the financial services industry. Can you expand a little bit on how you see this play out, where you see this going?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm going to, again, speak really from an enablement perspective, right? Throwing back to my earlier comment, there's just such a wide variety of ways that AI can be leveraged. But certainly when I think about, you know, the role of AI from an enablement perspective, there's a lot there that can be done, first and foremost, to support the needs of, you know, that those client-facing teams, the banker, right? And thinking about certainly the role they're playing. We've talked a lot about the need for that human element in the relationship and what's needed for that banker when they're having that conversation, right? Knowing that providing value, providing resources and content and education is so vitally important as part of that relationship and providing meaningful updates so that banker is well positioned to support that client, be it a business client or an individual client. So certainly we're thinking about how can AI be used to really reduce the admin time that a banker is spending, right, in terms of preparing for meetings, delivering meetings, and following up in those meetings. And when we think about the preparation, it's, okay, well, what kind of content needs to be prepared? Is it easy for me to source it and find it? And AI plays a really fantastic role in making sure that you're sourcing content in the walls of your organization that is on brand, it's compliant, and it's really certainly helping with that. We're also, you know, certainly thinking about, I think chatbots is, you know, definitely a big part of kind of the AI landscape, just in terms of, you know, I think everyone's thought about chatbots in the realm of supporting the client relationship, and that's certainly valuable and important, but it does play a vital role in terms of how a head office can support the needs of their sales organization, their bankers, right? And making sure they have an ability to ask questions and not always have to be calling around the head office for that, to answer that question. They're getting that answer in that moment of need. Because look, a customer could be on the phone with them and they really need to be timely in their response. I think also, you know, certainly, you know, beyond that too, is really thinking about content creation, right? And I think that's going to be a really exciting area. And I think, you know, all of us are just really scratching the surface on what that could look like, just in terms of giving more prompts in terms of how content can be created with that goal of ultimate personalization on a one-to-one basis. So I think that's going to be certainly, you know, another area that we're seeing. And really, you know, kind of in closing, you know, as I think about kind of that meetings, you know, prep, delivery, and follow-up, I think AI can play an incredibly valuable role in that follow-up, right? And really being able to say, okay, we're recording the meeting and it's not just a static recording. I'm getting really fantastic insights powered by AI. So I know explicitly what I need to do. So I've had a conversation with any of you here today, and I know I can do a very fast and pointed and personalized follow-up based on all the insights that the AI engine is telling me that I need to act on. And having that, I think, you know, when I think about AI, I get really, you know, excited because it's another powerful set of data. And you think about the power of integration and bringing that all together, that means that like your client data is going to be infinitely more valuable.
Yeah, it's really exciting where you can see where this is leading us and how it's going to enable us all in our jobs. And it goes back to that piece at the beginning of where we mentioned that you're stitching together the different parts of an organization. And I think this AI capability is really going to take us into that role much more. And Kerry, I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts as a leader. You know, it's one thing to take on all these new technologies and innovations, but how would you talk to leaders who want to encourage adoption of new technologies within the industry?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Gemma. I mean, I think, look, we're talking about all this technology, but it can seem a little overwhelming. And I think also in financial services, like there's plenty of pockets where people haven't really, you know, jumped in all in on using the technology because they've been so successful doing what they're doing, right? Knowing that, as I talked about earlier, at the core of financial services, it is a relationship management business. So those individuals who are really effective from that perspective are always, regardless of the technology they're using, they're going to be really successful in what they do. So I think you really have to kind of go in when you're thinking about a digital transformation initiative or any kind of change management, like knowing that, right? It's all about how do you, you know, really uplift all of that, really acknowledge everyone's success and just saying, you know, technology is going to be a force multiplier. It's going to make you more productive. It's going to put you in a better position to really modernize everything that you're doing in so that you're actually being able to spend more time on the things that you really like to do. And that is really around like spending time with the clients and really being able to support them at every turn. And as well as being really proactive and really like looking at the relationship and thinking about like ways you can add value beyond kind of what's been discussed. So I think that's, you know, certainly I think going in from that perspective, adding on to that, I think the firms that have been really successful with driving technology adoption are really thinking intentionally, like what's in it for the banker? Like a lot of, you know, initiatives have gotten, I think in the past were rolled out, like this is going to help the institution in XYZ ways, or this is going to help the client in this way. And certainly it's important for the institution to get benefit. It's of course hugely important for the client to have a valuable experience at every turn, but you can't miss out that like third, that critical third leg of the stool, right? Mm-hmm. What's the value for the banker, right? And I think that's really important. And I think the firms that think about their bankers with the same rigor and focus as they do for their clients, they're seeing greater success out of their change management and their digital transformation initiatives. I also think a layer on top of that, and that's something certainly we're thinking about a lot here at Seismic and really pouring that into our technology offering, is really this concept of peer-to-peer learning and sharing, right? Knowing how vital and important that is, right? And building a community of advocates, right? Knowing that if you have a peer who's kind of quote unquote carrying the bag, doing the same thing you're doing every day, and they're getting some success on using a particular piece of technology, like you really want to evangelize that more and more, right? Because it's just going to add more heft and credibility to your initiative. So I think that's from my perspective. And I also think carefully around the sequencing, right? Because I think a lot of times big digital transformation initiatives will happen, in particular large institutions, and they're almost putting too much change into the organization at once, right? As opposed to really taking a page of what technology companies do and thinking more agile, right? Less about these like big bang moments of like, here's 20 new pieces of technology. They're going to help your practice in like infinite amount of ways. You're probably going to be best positioned to kind of break it apart a bit and say, here are a few pieces and we're going to be rolling out more, you know, in the coming weeks, in the coming months. And I think kind of having that agile rolling approach is going to really set you up for success.
Completely agree. Conrad, how do you tackle adoption of products once you've started strategizing how to create them? How do you then start to encourage people to adopt the use of them?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a great believer in a concept that I think it was popularized by Amazon. I don't know if they invented it, but they talk about one-way doors and two-way doors. So most decisions and most launches are two-way doors. In other words, if you do the launch correctly, you can go through the door. And if it doesn't work well, you can go back through the door. And occasionally you go through a one-way door, where in other words, it's very hard to go back. And I find, I mean, coming back to the point that was just being made about Big Bang, by the way, large incumbents very often create one-way doors for themselves by making everything a Big Bang. And if the Big Bang goes wrong, it's extremely hard because they've kind of put everything, you know, going live at once. So we try desperately hard to make most of our moves forward to be two-way doors. And the art of that is, you know, small incremental releases and small incremental improvements. And, you know, there is a real compounding factor, right? If your operational capabilities, your product development moves forward a bit every 2 weeks, and then before you know it, it's moved forward a lot. Yeah. So to answer your question, when we try and release things into the wild, we actually try and do it in quite a constrained, limited way. In other words, we're not trying to push, you know, mass market adoption on day one. So it has a much, much higher chances of poor consequences. Typical things, we will have, you know, release switches that allow us to expose features to a small number of customers, for example. So, and it's obviously A-B testing is another strategy, particularly in terms of content and sort of brochureware design. So fundamentally, we try and make things in small releases as small as possible. We have friends and family testing as kind of phase one for anything that involves real money. To be clear, friends and family testing. So I'll open a savings account and see if it works before we release it to our real customers, although technically I'm a real customer in that case. And penny testing is very popular in financial services, and you can guess what that is, whichever side of the Atlantic you're on. So we try desperately hard to make our releases small and manageable and above all else reversible and avoid the big bang. In other words, we only actually really put the foot down when we're confident that it's ready for the big time. So it's kind of the other way around. We don't try and drive huge success on overnight. We think that's high risk. So let me give an example. So we launched our business current account, which is kind of our sort of key to our building a banking franchise. That will be a business checking account if you're in America. So we initially released that to a small number of our existing customers. And then we released it to the open market. But acquiring customers in that space is extremely hard to do. So it was quite easy for us to control the customer numbers simply because unless you try extremely hard, you're not going to get many customers. And actually, just as we went into 2024, the current year, we really, turned on the taps and started building out a lot of channels and a lot of channel experiments so we can actually do as much as we can because we're confident it's ready for the big time. So we kind of try and take that approach. And I find it extraordinary, actually, institutions that don't. I don't see any other way. And interestingly, actually, our regulator, the Financial Conduct Authority, did an analysis of this. And they concluded that agile ways of doing things is lower risk. But somehow still lots of incumbents have these enormous transformation programs and they try and drop everything, you know, after 4 years, they try and drop everything at once. And just because they've had a governance meeting, they think everything's going to be okay. But actually Agile has even been advocated for by our regulator now because they've looked at the data. They've looked at millions of transformation events and it turns out that it's the best way of doing things.
So we're now going to wrap up our conversation, and it's been a fascinating discussion. I think we've touched on so many areas that actually could become a conversation in their own right. But I'm going to ask everybody to give me one word, sort of a key takeaway from what we've talked about today, and maybe a sentence explaining why you've chosen word.
Okay, that's a great question, Rachel. I love it. Let's see, if I had to think of like the one word, I think it's like customer centricity, right? And I think thinking about the brand of a customer through a variety of different lenses, as I just talked about earlier. Like, it is certainly the end client, right? It's the end relationship that's the most important. But also thinking about the individuals, the bankers in this case, that are in front of those clients, and thinking that with them is like kind of the same rigor and discipline as you would for your end client. I think they're carrying the baton in many ways of driving the client relationship and the client experience and the reputation of the institution. So I think the firms that are thinking with a customer-centric mindset, but applying it perhaps a little bit more broadly, are the ones that are really going to be successful in terms of bringing new products and services to the market, really driving, you know, new ways to leverage technology, and really growing their businesses in a way that aligns to a very complicated regulatory landscape.
Excellent. Thank you, Kerry. And Conrad, you've had a little bit of thinking time, so I'll pass the baton over to you.
Yeah, you know, my overriding message would be get on with it. So let me just unpick that a bit. What I see in incumbents, and I came from big banks, by the way, so I've seen this on the inside, and it's now I've gone through the journey of founding a startup, but, you know, just me in my bedroom at the weekend to you know, in the end, fairly consequential business. There are 100 reasons not to move something forward. And I think there's a tendency in large organizations to think that you're progressing things if you're writing PowerPoint slides or writing Word documents. The reality is anything related to software, the only thing that moves you forward is software code. So rather than kind of focus on almost the kind of ready aim culture of kind of like just endlessly analyzing and just building up more and more pressure of things that need to happen. And then when they happen, things go wrong. Just get on with it and actually focus your resources on trying to de-risk real life activity. So in other words, you know, one of the things I always encourage my teams to do is basically governance really matters in a bank. It doesn't matter whether you're a small one or a big one, it really, really matters. But in the end, right, we can't go to prison for thinking about things. So, you know, in the end, why don't we engage, for example, our governance functions like compliance early at a, you know, high level, and then just get on with it up until the point we think we're ready to launch, then go and say, okay, we need a detailed review. And this is how we're going to manage the risks and make sure that we can actually come back and go back through the door if things go wrong. So rather than focus on endlessly analyzing and writing PowerPoint and Word documents, focus on ways to get into the market quickly at the lowest risk.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thanks so much. And Gemma, over to you for your word.
I will go with empathy, because I would say my takeaway from today is the point that Conrad made earlier, which is understand the problem that you're trying to solve, take it on as your own problem, and then you'll solve it in the way that's needed.
Great, thank you. And my word, so I'm going to go, I was quite taken by Conrad's word opti-channel. So I'm going to go with that, because I think it kind of brings together also that customer obsession idea and really meeting your customers where they are in the way they want to be engaged with value in each conversation that you have. So that would be my takeaway. I've learned a new word, so that's always a good thing to be able to go away with a learning, I guess. But I would really like to thank you both, Kerry, Conrad. It's been a fantastic conversation. Gemma and I have really enjoyed talking to you today. And thank you very much for your time.
You've been listening to Seismic Sessions, enabling the financial services industry. Don't forget to like and subscribe to stay up to date with the latest opinions on all things revenue enablement within the financial sector.